weekdays from 4.
105 Drive with Julian Clover.
Seeing you home.
Every month on the programme, Dom Smith wanders through the museums of Cambridge, and we're going to do that just now. So, welcome, Dom.
Good evening.
Hello, and where are you taking us this time around?
Well, we're going down a bit of an odd alleyway, if you like. We're going down to the Sigswick Avenue site of the University of Cambridge, so a little bit out of the city centre, hidden away, if you like, on the first floor of the Department of Classics in the university. It's the Museum of Classical Archaeology. Hardly anyone that seems to know it's there. And it's a fantastic place and very unusual because one of the main features of it is that it's got, as you might imagine, lots of classical statues, but they're all plaster casts, mainly from the 19th century. And so I started by asking Dr. Suzanne Turner, the curator there, whether it's sort of unusual to have a museum full of these plaster casts.
Poor plaster casts, they have not had a good time of it in the last 100 years. So we are one of very few large-scale surviving plaster cast collections in the UK and on the continent. So we're very lucky, actually, that our casts have continued to live with us to this day. Of course, they had a little wobbly moment when we moved out of Peterhouse College and moved over to this site. And for a little while there, I think it looked as if maybe we'd be saying goodbye to the casts. But we're very lucky because now today we have this beautiful, bright and airy, purpose-built cast gallery that situates us directly within the Faculty of Classics.
Right, and the casts, just to be clear, are plaster casts of statues from both the Greek and Roman eras?
Yeah, so everything we've got here is a plaster cast, so that makes it a direct copy of something that's somewhere else in the world today, which actually makes us in so many ways a really weird collection, because I'm basically telling you that we're a collection of fakes. Now, my poor babies, my poor plaster casts, they're not really fakes because they've never ever tried to be something that they're not. And actually, again, we're really lucky here because we have them all together in one place, we don't have to travel to see them side by side. So they're a fantastic teaching resource. And our purpose-built gallery here, although it has breeze blocks, so it's not the most architecturally significant of buildings, what it lets us do is tell a chronological story of change through time. So even when you come in here, if you don't know anything about classical art, you can walk through our gallery and see for yourself the types of changes that happen over time. And that's a story that you can only really tell when you've built up a collection through deliberate choice in order to fill in gaps and build a kind of cohesive collection, rather than, say, build one through serendipity, through what comes on the art market at particular times. So there are definite advantages to my plaster casts. I think that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Right, okay, so for example, I guess that explains also a bit about how this gallery complements some of the other collections around Cambridge. So in the Fitzwilliam Museum, for example, you've got some of the originals, but other originals are dotted all around the world. And so what you've done here is basically bring all of that together into one place.
Yeah, absolutely. I suppose here in Cambridge, our university museums often have very tangled histories. We're all linked to each other. So our collection actually began in the Fitzwilliam Museum. The earliest plaster casts that we have were gifts to the Fitz in the year that it opened. And in fact, plaster casts formed the foundation of their antiquities collection that they have now today. And so we separated off. We were formally separated in 1884, and that's when we were founded. But then we were joined with the Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology. And then we both split off in the early 20th century. So actually, we're all joined up and linked together, not just through the ways in which, if you wander between our collections, you'll see links, but also through our histories.
Right, and you said earlier that the gallery at one point was based inside Peterhouse College.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we had for 100 years in 1884, we signed a lease with Peterhouse College, and what is now their library was originally the Museum of Classical and General Archaeology, I think it was called. And in fact, the sign is still above the door. And so there we were in a series of kind of little rooms, and the casts told a sort of chronological story, but not quite as explicitly as they do in here today.
Tell us a little bit about some of the main pieces you've got here, the main exhibits, some of the most important statues and other casts you've got.
Yeah, I guess we all have some favourites, don't we? I mean, we have kind of lots of stars of the show, I suppose. So one of our favourites is the Farnese Hercules, which it used to be our biggest cast, but is not anymore. We got a larger one in 2007. And he was one of the earliest casts in the collection, and he's absolutely enormous. So he's a kind of Roman figure of Hercules, looking weary and tired. You have to really kind of glance behind his back to see what he's holding in his hand, because he's got the apples of the Hesperides. So that lets you put together that this is him after his kind of last labour. And he's, even though he's enormous, he towers above your head. It's also him at his most human, when he's his most tired and he's not yet become a god. So that still seems out of reach. We have basically all of the stars of the show, really, of classical sculpture. So we've got a Dorypheros. In fact, we've got multiple Dorypheroi. So these are statues. The original was made by a sculptor called Polykleitos, and he made it not just so he could make another naked man, because goodness knows we have a lot of naked men in our gallery, but because he had a theory about how you should sculpt the perfect male figure. And it was all about proportion, how many heads tall the body should be, the legs to the knee should be, etc., etc., so that every measurement within the body was entirely relational. Unfortunately, his original bronze sculpture only survives now in copies, and so we have several of those copies, and they don't quite measure up, so it's hard to get back at the original theory. But he's a prime example of one of the important pieces that we have. But we also, I mean, we have casts from the Parthenon, from the Temple of Apollo at Bassae. We have a fair few bits from Pompeii and Herculaneum actually scattered through the gallery. So we have things from across the Greek and Roman world, including Britain. We have a Claudius head, a decapitated Claudius head. So we've got all sorts.
Well, Dr. Turner's just brought me round the corner to the Terme Boxer. Dr. Turner, why is this such an important item in the collection?
Well, it's our most recent acquisition. We don't get new objects very often, because you might have noticed we're quite a busy and packed space. Space is at a premium here. But this was too good an opportunity to miss, really. He came from an artist's barn in Shropshire to come and live with us. And when he came to us, he was bright white, because he was just plaster, but the original is beautiful polychrome bronze. So it's hollow cast bronze, and the Terme Boxer, you guys can't see it at home, but this is an example of Hellenistic, sometimes called genre art, because instead of focusing on a beautiful ideal youth, this is an aging boxer, completely battered and exhausted after he's just been in battle. He's still got the gloves on his hands, and he's covered in cuts and bruises. In the original, it's almost as if his skin kind of swells with the bruises underneath. So we wanted to try and recapture some of that. With in the original, the extra little details are added in copper. So it took us a week, but we managed it. We had great help from Bob Baum of Museum Technical Services, and we had to put on a kind of layer of brown paint, and then the bronze that you see is actually literally powdered bronze, which was brushed onto the surface, and then it was toned down, because he did look a little bit gilded at that point, toned down with another thinner layer of paint, so that now we get this kind of beautiful burnished effect, and then with all the blood and gore and extra bits and his luscious lips added in kind of copper effect as well. So he's a really wonderful addition to our gallery, I think.
And it's about life size. It looks as if he's exactly the size that a boxer would have been.
Yeah, he's pretty big. Yeah. So he's really impressive. It's really, and we have behind him a picture of his discovery, with him kind of sitting nonchalantly in what is probably a posed excavation dig, I would imagine. But it's really effective, I think, and it also allows us, I think, to recapture some of the sheer variety of classical art. It's not all just naked young men and naked ladies. There's more to it than that.
I believe also you've got a big collection of shards of pottery which aren't actually on display here.
We do. We have about 10,000 sherds, which are kind of little broken pieces of pottery, but also of other artefacts. So some of them, for instance, we've got bits of marble from Rome. And they were primarily built up to be a teaching collection. And at the moment, we're undertaking quite a big and exhausting project to inventory them all, to make sure they're in the right drawers and we know where everything is. And in the process, we're finding lots of lovely examples of kind of funny little bits and interesting pieces. So we're putting those photos on Twitter, and we've dedicated a cabinet to them as well, because if we're going to put all this work in, it's the type of thing that usually only happens behind the scenes. You don't see it, so we might as well try and communicate with people the fun that we're having as we look in those dusty drawers and what we're finding as we go.
Excellent. And just talking about communicating with people, I know that you're not just a gallery that people can walk around sort of looking at the statues and looking at their artistic value, but also you have various events that are open to the public as well, don't you?
We do. We're only little, so we only have 3 staff who essentially work the hours of 2 people, but we work very hard on events and we take them very seriously. So we run a really packed summer programme usually for summer at the museums. We've just done Twilight as well, which is mayhem, absolute mayhem when everyone comes in after dark. And we often organise events that represent our faculty, not just us. So we organise events that aren't just about our collection or our objects, but also about classics more generally. So we have talks, we're looking at doing more crafty exercises and events. And one of our big success stories actually from last year was Drink and Draw, which was enormous for us. It was the first time we ever had queues. So we're running that twice again this summer, but this time we're ticketing it so no one has to stand outside waiting to get in.
So what does that involve?
Oh, it's really fun. So we get a couple of artists to come in. So we've got the professionals there on hand and we let everyone have a glass of wine and we provide drawing materials and pencils, and it's in the evening, but obviously it's in the summer, so it's not dark. So you've got the beautiful light coming in from the glass roof, and then you can just sit and draw to your heart's content. And to be honest, when we first did it, we thought it would be the drink that would draw people in, but actually it was the drawing. And it was just lovely to have the gallery full of people kind of convivially drawing and participating and enjoying the casts. And of course, one of the great histories, I suppose, of the cast is their role in a fine art education, so it's important to us as well that we nod to that in some of our events.
Brilliant. So that's one we keep an eye on the website, and more information on that event and other events will be published in the course as we approach the summer.
I think the first one's in May, and I think it's already on the website actually, but we're not opening tickets until 2 weeks before, just to try and keep tabs on how many get used.
Lovely. Dr. Suzanne Turner, the curator here at the Museum of Classical Archaeology, thanks very much for sparing the time to talk to us here on Cambridge 105.
And that drink and draw event that Suzanne referred to there is actually on Friday the 6th of May. It's from 7 p.m. Booking will open on the 25th of April. There's more information on their website, which is classics.cam.ac.uk, classics.cam.ac.uk/museum. And you've got the entry times as well. The entry is free. It's a little bit complicated, though. It's open 10 till 5, Monday to Friday. It's also open on Saturdays during the university full term.
Which is when?
Which is when. So that'll be from the 23rd of April right up to the start of June. So there is no summer, no opening on Saturdays during the summer. But if you get in during May from the 23rd of April onwards, there is Saturday opening then.
I think I got that. But there's details of all of that on their website,
exactly,
weren't there?
Yes.
Okay, Dom, thank you very much. Did you get much chance to look around, by the way?
Yes, I did, yes, and it was absolutely fascinating. Lots and lots of exhibits in there.
Okay, Dom Smith, thanks. So thank you very much. They will pop a podcast of that on the website in the next little while. It's 6:14.